Hello, I'm Eric Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided to the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is quite timely, What Dad Wants This Father's Day by Roland Fryer. Then Jason Riley has American Idol, The Work Ethic Goes Out of Style. We'll follow that up with Peter Grant's article, Longevity is the Newest Amenity for the Rich. Alan Woodward has New Clues on Why We Prefer One Hand Over the Other. And we'll follow that up with Joe Brown's The Biggest Day in Sports History. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, What Dad Wants This Father's Day. My favorite Father's Day gifts are a terrible breakfast concocted by my daughters and an afternoon at the smoker where no one mentions what the ribs are doing to my arteries. For the record, I am the primary cook in my house, and I do most of the driving to club soccer games, where I am an unofficial sideline coach, a role the actual coach specifically asked me not to take. What I receive most years are socks that say, number one dad, last minute arts and crafts, and the occasional grill gadget, a catalog essentially unchanged since 1965. The American father has been transformed significantly over the past half century, but the gifts that honor him have not, and the gap between the two is worth a little economic reasoning. The Pew Research Center, analyzing long-run time-use data, found that fathers spent about 2.5 hours a week on childcare in 1965. By 2011, that figure nearly tripled to 7.3 hours, while their housework roughly doubled. They did not buy that time by stepping back from work, paid hours fell modestly, and 93.7% of fathers with minor children are still in the labor force. So the new caregiving came out of their own leisure. The cause was not ideological, but arithmetic. The old bargain of household specialization, one spouse in the market, one in the home, concentrating where they were most productive, became unaffordable as women's earnings rose. Over the same 50 years, the share of marriages in which the wife is the sole or primary breadwinner roughly tripled from about 5% to 16%. The care that mothers supplied still had to be done, and more of it fell to fathers. Even paternity leave, one of the costliest signals a father can send, has risen from less than one in five employees first-time fathers before the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993 to about half of more recent births. Newer time use research finds that, since the pandemic, fathers of young children have again traded paid hours for caregiving, nearly one for one. Today's dad is not the provider father of 1965, whom the holiday was built to honor. He is a different man doing different work, and when his family asks what he wants this Father's Day, most of the time he says nothing. I wanted to know whether that nothing was true. So I conducted a survey of 1,000 American fathers recruited to reflect the national population by age, race, and region, and I asked them what they expected to receive on Father's Day, what they actually wanted, and why the two so often diverge. Among the fathers I surveyed, nearly two-thirds expect to receive something other than what they want, but asked what they actually wanted, fathers did not hold back. They want experience, a day fishing, a round of golf with two friends, or as one father wrote, an afternoon out doing something we usually don't do that I like. None of this is exotic. A fishing trip or ball game is something the market provides readily and relatively cheaply. If this is what fathers want, and it is no harder to give them a gadget, why do we all have number one dad socks? Some of what fathers want, though, isn't a purchase at all. Nearly 3 in 10 say the gift they would most value is recognition of the caregiving they do. Not a drugstore card, but genuine acknowledgement of the lunches, the logistics, the doctor's appointments. These are men doing real volumes of that work, a median of 20 hours a week of hands-on care, and 6 more of the administrative kind, scheduling, school emails, appointment bookings, that the time use survey show migrating onto fathers over 2 generations. This is the part of the puzzle that should be easy. Recognition costs nothing. A family that wanted to give it could do so before breakfast. So why don't they? The answer isn't that families are unable to give it or unwilling. The failure is not on the giving end. It is that the average father would sooner eat the grill brush than ask to be thanked, and I built the survey specifically to find out why. Before I asked fathers what they most wanted, I varied how the question was set up. Some got it straight. Others I first prompted, gently, that some men feel it's more dignified not to ask for anything on Father's Day, and invited them to set that feeling aside. The logic was simple. If an unspoken rule is suppressing what fathers admit they want, naming the rule and waving it away should change their answers. It did. When fathers were reminded that the dignified thing is to want nothing, and given permission to ignore that script, the share choosing acknowledgement as their most wanted gift rose by 25%. Asked directly, fathers described the rule themselves. 63% wrote that it is more dignified for a man not to ask for anything on Father's Day. 58% agree that asking for credit for caregiving feels unmanly. And 59% admit that when asked what they want, their answer is nothing, even though, by their own account, they have clear preferences. Only 32% endorse the more cynical proposition that they say nothing because no one really cares. Fathers are not silent because they've given up. They are silent because asking for acknowledgement violates the man code. And that code binds tightest on the men with the most to acknowledge. Among fathers who handle the largest share of caregiving, 73% expect a gift other than the one they want, compared with 60% of those who do the least. Economists like to say markets are good at pricing what people value. Father's Day exposes the condition buried inside that claim. A market can clear only on what people are willing to ask for. The American father has been remade, but a holiday built on stated wants can only honor the wants he states, and he has learned to state none. As for me, this is the year I will stop saying nothing. I'm going for burnt pancakes, a family fishing trip, and, if my daughters are willing, an admission out loud that those close soccer games were won on the strength of my sideline insights. And now, American Idol, the work ethic goes out of style. Maybe you've seen that old video clip on social media. It's the one in which comedian Chris Rock explains how to tell good from bad neighborhoods based simply on who is not working in the middle of the day. If you're in any neighborhood in America at 12:15 in the afternoon on a Wednesday, and you see women with sweatpants on, coming out the gym, pushing babies, riding bikes, Mr. Rock explains, chances are you're in a nice neighborhood. There's probably a Whole Foods nearby. But if you see men in sweatpants smoking cigarettes, hanging with their boys, lifting weights in the yard, riding children's bicycles as their actual transportation, then you are in danger. Mr. Rock's funny and insightful bit came to mind as I read a recent jobs report. which showed that the share of American men in the labor force had dipped to record lows. According to the Department of Labor, 1 in 3 men were neither working nor looking for a job as recently as April. Among males 20 and older, the 66% labor force participation rate is down from 73% in 2006. Mr. Rock was highlighting the correlation between unemployment and crime, but public safety is not the only concern raised by a large population of idle young males. The premature absence of millions of able-bodied men from our workforce, combined with the continuing retirement of the baby boomers and significant reductions in immigration, bodes ill for the country. A life without gainful employment has become a viable alternative for an increasing number of American males. COVID job disruptions did not help, but the problem of men in their prime working years, 25 to 54, exiting the job market, long predates the pandemic. In his book, Men Without Work, demographer Nicholas Eberstadt reported that the work rate for men 20 and older fell by more than 13 percentage points between 1965 and 2015. During that half century, he added, the fraction of men without jobs of any sort in the broad 20 to 64 group went from 10% of the total to almost 22%, and the percentage of wholly jobless prime age men shot from 6% to nearly 16%. The long-term rise in male joblessness does not stem from an inability to find employment. It results instead from an unwillingness to search for work. And while labor force participation rates vary by race and ethnicity, factors other than hiring discrimination seem to be playing a larger role in the disparity. The legacy of prejudice might seem to explain why prime age male work rates and workforce participation are lower for blacks than whites today, but they cannot explain why work rates and LFPRs for white men today are decidedly lower than they were for black men in 1965, Mr. Eberstadt wrote. Nor can they explain why labor participation rates of married black men 25 to 64 are higher than the never married white men in the same age group. Some blame technological advancements and deindustrialization for the increase in male idleness, but those barriers are hardly insurmountable. Like married men who are trying to support their families, foreign-born males who come to the United States in search of work also tend to have higher work rates, notwithstanding globalization and other macroeconomic trends. Neither married men nor immigrants are stealing these jobs. Rather, they are seizing employment opportunities that others spurn. The most likely culprit is a social safety net full of generous government benefits that allow men who won't work to subsist. Welfare and disability programs at the state and federal level are well funded by the political left, are easily gained by design, and have become a significant source of income for men with no job and no interest in finding one. Because these men often have no problem mooching off the women who take them in, they are able to live on welfare payments sent to others in the same household. Democrats in Washington often look to Europe as a social welfare model for the United States. A recent Wall Street Journal editorial on Britain's workforce woes ought to give them pause. According to a new report from former Labor Health Secretary Alan Milburn, nearly a million Brits under 25 are not employed in school or in job training. Nearly half of Britain's idle youth now claim to have a work-limiting disability, the journal noted. And around 7 in 10 youth who claim the disability benefit are still on it a decade later. Europe's large safety net is not a model for America. It's a cautionary tale. And longevity is newest amenity for the rich. The newest luxury condominium amenity for wealthy New Yorkers is not a rooftop pool, private dining room, or celebrity chef restaurant. It is a whole body MRI. One High Line, the mixed-use development that emerged from one of New York's real estate's biggest blow-ups, has leased its five-story commercial space to Atria Health and Research Institute, a high-end longevity company. Atria offers advanced diagnostics, including MRIs, genetic screening, and advanced heart imaging to members paying roughly $20,000 to $75,000 a year. The Institute won't have to look far for customers. With sweeping Hudson River views, One High Line has sold most of its 236 condominiums for prices in the $3 million to $50 million range. Its two towers, which opened back in 2023, are anchored by a Faini luxury hotel and include a pool, spa, restaurant, and other luxury hospitality services. One High Line's developers, Witkoff Group and billionaire Len Blavatnik, see the clinic as another high-end feature they can sell to the well-heeled as part of the broader luxury ecosystem. It could have been someone's office space, said Jonah Sonnenborg, head of Access Real Estate, part of Blavatnik's empire. But then it obviously is not going to offer a great amenity for all the people staying in the hotel or the residences. The deal reflects the latest turn in luxury amenities. Developers are increasingly chasing very affluent consumers by offering them longer lives through medical technology. Atria opened its first clinic back in 2022 at 432 Park Avenue, one of the first condominiums on Manhattan's Billionaires Row. The company has since opened or announced facilities in Palm Beach, Florida, Beverly Hills, California, Miami's Design District, and Menlo Park, California. You have enough restaurants and coffee shops in New York, said Alan Tisch, Atria's chief executive and co-founder. Having a leading health, wellness, and longevity center is really a differentiator today. The wealthy, of course, have always spent heavily to stay healthy. The elite used to travel to take the waters at European resorts. More recently, they have extended their lives through spas, trainers, and concierge doctors who offer rich patients more time and access. What is changing is the rise of the technology-heavy longevity industry that combines diagnostics, interventions, and continuous tracking into a new kind of premium health business. There are roughly 350 longevity clinics worldwide that package whole body scans, genetic testing, biomarker monitoring, and personalized medicine, according to Philip Newman, founder of Longevity.Technology, a research and media company. Fewer than 20 of these, though, have been combined with residential projects. But the model is spreading across multiple sectors, including gyms, private medical groups, telehealth companies, and luxury real estate projects. There's obviously money to be made in helping to keep people healthy and have longer lives, Newman said. The longevity theme carries a certain irony at One High Line itself. An earlier project did not survive. The current development emerged only after new owners stepped in to remake a stalled and financially troubled venture. The group whose project failed, led by HFZ Capital Group, purchased the site back in 2015 for a startling $870 million, one of the highest amounts ever paid for a Manhattan parcel. Rising costs, delays, turmoil within HFZ, and funding shortfalls pushed the development into distress. By 2021, the project had flatlined. In late 2021, the Witkoff and Blavatnik Group became the project's new owners through a negotiated agreement with HFZ involving the purchase of project debt and foreclosure proceedings. The takeover came at an uneasy time. New York was still emerging from the pandemic, wealthy residents had fled, and few developers wanted to gamble on a half-built luxury condominium project. But the new owners saw value. They were acquiring a rare full-block site beside the High Line Park, nearly completed towers, and little competing luxury supply in the pipeline. The group paid $900 million, about one-third of the prior owner's investment, while taking over a development that was already nearing completion. That gave the new owners flexibility on pricing and a cushion against market swings. The upside was much, much higher than any downside of the project, said Alec Witkoff, CEO of Witkoff Group, and son of founder Steve Witkoff, who is now an advisor to President Trump. Lately, new risks have been emerging for New York's ultra-luxury condo market. Buyers might be discouraged by the city's fiscal strains and a growing push to tax wealthy residents, a sentiment reflected in the new pied-a-terre tax championed by Mayor Zoran Mamdani. Witkoff said that the One High Line is relatively inoculated from this pressure because its condos are already about 90% sold for about $1.5 billion in proceeds. Earlier this year, the developer secured a $525 million refinancing for the project from Ares Management and J.P. Morgan. The owners are also betting that new amenities will help keep wealthy buyers interested. Atria is scheduled to open its 52,000 square foot facility connecting the two towers in the fall of 2027 with MRI and imaging suites, movement studios, patient rooms, and a longevity cafe offering healthy food, teas, and juices overlooking the Hudson. Layer in longevity creates the perfect mix, said Tish. And now, new clues on why we prefer one hand over the other. Have a tendency to reach for a racket, a pen, or a glass of water with one specific hand? New research traces the answer back millions of years to the time when our ancestors stood up. When we shifted from climbing trees with four limbs to walking upright on two, we freed up our hands for gripping food, hunting, and even crafting tools. A preferred hand made such tasks more efficient, according to a recent paper in the journal PLOS Biology. And coupled with a growing brain, more on that in a bit, the right hand later emerged as a clear favorite. No other primate species shows such a strong preference for one hand over another. 90% of people are right-handed. We are unique for how strong our handedness is, the fact that most humans are going to use their dominant limb for essentially everything they do, said Rachel Hurwitz, a University of Oxford biological anthropologist and co-author of the recent paper. The research examined studies on 41 primate species, along with some human ancestors. They identified hallmarks of humanity, such as tool use, habitat, diet, social structure, brain size, and upright walking. Statistical modeling concluded that brain size and walking upright best explain our one-hand bias. A timeline helps provide the picture. About 6 million years ago or so, our ancestors transitioned from climbing trees to walking on two legs, opening up the possibility of having a preferred hand. The level of dexterity and control humans have is only possible thanks to this high level of specialization and directionality, said Thomas Puchel, an Oxford evolutionary anthropologist and another co-author. The bias towards the right hand in particular came later in our evolutionary history. About 3 million years ago, human ancestors started developing bigger brains, and dedicated parts began to control different functions. The brain's left side became responsible for language, logical reasoning, and coordinating tool use. That region also controls the right hand, which some scientists believe helped explain the right-hand bias. Still, some mysteries linger. After all, there are plenty of lefties, and it is not that left-handed folks have smaller brains, Hurwitz said. And we do have one more, the biggest day in sports history. 60 years ago this month, the fledgling American Football League and the rival National Football League announced plans to merge. The news broke at a small press conference at the Warwick Hotel in New York City on June 8, 1966. It may be the most significant day in American sports history. I was fortunate to be an eyewitness and a participant of sorts. In 1966, I was a college intern at the NFL's office at One Rockefeller Center. When I began working, there were only 11 full-time employees, including Commissioner Pete Rozelle. Calling it a mom-and-pop office makes it sound bigger than it was, but it was the heartbeat of the league. Jim Kensel, Pete's right-hand man, summoned my mailroom colleague, Peter had some hazy and me to his office that afternoon. He told us in confidence that merger talks among Kansas City Chiefs owner Lamar Hunt, Dallas Cowboys president Tex Schramm, and Mr. Rozelle had concluded that morning. We were holding a 6 p.m. press conference at the Warwick, a nearby hotel, to announce peace between the two leagues. Mr. Kensel handed both of us a manila envelope. One was addressed to Associated Sports and the other to United Press International Sports. He told Mr. Hathaway to go to 50 Rock, where the AP was located, and ordered me to walk as fast as I could to UPI's 42nd Street headquarters. Mr. Kensel told us to telephone him when we reached our respective sports desks. Once he knew we were both in place, we were to hand over our envelopes, which contained the news release the sports world was anticipating. The AFL and NFL finally had merged into one league. No formal agreement had been signed, so the release had great import. When the press conference began that evening, Rozelle, Hunt, and Schramm sat together on a couch. Sports writers outnumbered the few local TV anchors. I also remember one rather loud local radio broadcaster, Howard Cosell. As Mr. Rozelle shared the details from the release, the significance of the merger became clear. Mr. Rozelle would be commissioner of the new combined league. Al Davis, who had recently become AFL commissioner, was out of a job. The two leagues would operate separately but peacefully under Mr. Rozelle until final implementation in 1970, when they were realigned into the American and National Conferences, with three existing NFL teams joining the AFC to equalize their membership. There would be annual championship game between the two leagues commencing at the end of the 1966 season, and both leagues would hold a common draft of college players, effectively ending a bidding war. We later returned to One Rockefeller Center to consider the loose ends over drinks in Mr. Rozelle's small office. I was the bartender and waiter. Since that merger announcement, pro football has become America's favorite sport by a wide margin. 60 Super Bowls, primetime football on TV, and a record 32 teams all evolved from that news conference at the Warwick. It's been a heck of a 60 years. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.